Your local McDonald's owners across Washington, D.C., Greater Baltimore, and Eastern Shore are committed community members who all celebrate the diversity of the neighborhoods that they serve. Black History Month is a special time to spotlight the many African American and Black individuals and organizations that have contributed to our area's growth and development. McDonald's sees, supports, and celebrates you now and all year long.
Welcome to the Midlife Male Podcast, a podcast designed to help men maximize middle age and live healthier, wealthier, stronger, and happier. I am Greg Scheinman, and I'm inviting you to join the thousands of men who listen each week, receive my Midlife Male newsletter, and are committed to making this next phase of life our best phase. If you have not yet downloaded my No BS Guide to Maximizing Midlife, where I break down the three principles to maximizing middle age and taking back some of that shit you've given up, head on over to midlifemail.com/No BS Guide. Guys are loving these three principles to maximizing middle age, and you can download your copy today at midlifemail.com/No BS Guide. All right, guys, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you are listening to the Midlife Male Podcast. Thank you so much for your support this week and every week. I am your host, Greg Scheinman. Couple of things before we get into this week's episode with the amazing Alan Ying. One, my book, The Midlife Male, is now available for pre-sale. So head on over to Amazon. Everybody knows where Amazon is. And all you got to do is search The Midlife Male, and you can place your order for The Midlife Male book, and it will be delivered to you on November 1st. So really excited about that. We've gotten some great response to this so far. It's already pre-selling extremely well, and I greatly appreciate it. I think you're going to find it, I think you're going to find it fun. I think you're going to find it vulnerable. There are some incredible stories from many of the men who have joined me on the podcast, and they share their advice, their tips, their experiences, their ups, their downs, their successes, their failures, and their life lessons learned. And it is a no-bullshit guide to living better, longer, happier, healthier, and wealthier, and having more fun in your 40s and 50s, which includes more sex, and what guy doesn't want that? Went for the longest possible title I could. So thank you so much for your support on that. I really, really appreciate it. And share that around, okay? Keep the Midlife Male message and community growing. To that effect, we are just about in October of 2022, which means fourth quarter, which really means we're thinking about where are we with the goals that we had set for 2022? What else can we accomplish by the end of the year to achieve those goals, get close to them? Where are we succeeding? Where are we struggling? And we are also now in the planning stages, and should be in the planning stages, for 2023. So, to that effect, I have two offers for you. One, it is a 90-minute strategy session directly with me, where we will be working on planning your map, your purpose, process, and payoff, your personal operating system, and going through the 5 steps to maximize middle age. That is a 90-minute session with me with 2 weeks of follow-up. And it is a great way to finish the year strong and also get set up properly for the year ahead. Second is my 90-day coaching program. This is narrow and deep. It is one-on-one with me. It is every week we are meeting, and we are, again, working through in a much deeper one-on-one weekly accountable basis to help you design the life that you want to live. So you can check all of the information out on both of those at midlifemail.com. You can also email me, greg@midlifemail.com. Or if you're over on Instagram, @GregScheinman, you can shoot me a DM, and I am happy to set up a free introductory call with me and see if we're the right fit for each other, answer any questions you might have, and go from there. All right, let's talk about a prolific midlife male right now, serial entrepreneur, husband, father, author, the amazing Alan Yang. Alan and I have known each other for years. Our children went to school together early on in Montessori, and now they are also in school together in high school right now. Alan has had a tremendous career and has made some unbelievable decisions throughout his life, and you're going to hear him talk about those on the show. Risks that he has taken to put himself out there that people have said were absolutely crazy at the time and that have ultimately worked out for him for a number of different reasons. And again, the metric for success is different for all of us as men. And capitalizing on all of his success and all of his experience, Alan has gone out and written an incredible book called The Risk Paradox, Life Lessons from 102 Amazing Risk Takers. He did this with his former business partner, Doug Schneider. Don't want to leave Doug out of the mix. Doug did a lot of the writing. Alan did a lot of the interviews and the editing, and he also narrated the audiobook. So that's going to be available for you as well. And what they really did was they took a look about real life risk, jobs, families, hopes, fears, dreams, disappointments, and how they mix with money, achievements, and life fulfillment. These are kind of squishy topics and they all jumble together in everyone's lives. And they went deep on it and they decided to write something that they actually wanted to read. And I think y'all are going to want to read it too. I certainly, gravitate towards this because everything we just described is exactly what we're all dealing with as men. So they found 102 people. They actually split it evenly between men and women. They conducted hundreds of hours of interviews. Most of the individuals that they interviewed had never shared their stories or discussed the turning points and risks in their lives. And they just collected and analyzed information. And they looked for patterns in the feelings and decisions, events, and backgrounds in the lives of these incredible people about how they approach risk and the risk paradox. And learning that taking risk is, in fact, the least risky thing you can do to live a fulfilling life. So with that in mind, let's get to it this week with Alan Yang on the Midwife Male Podcast. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Look, it's awesome to have you here. We've known each other for a while. I'm going to do the intro after we do this interview. So I'm assuming in the intro, everybody who's listening, now you know, like our kids went to school together, at a Montessori program. We got to know each other a little bit there. Not as much as we've subsequently gotten to know, one another. And I hope by the end of this hour, even more, and we'll shine a light on some other things. When you are had early success as an entrepreneur, continued success, and now you have gone on to become an author here. And I opened my inbox, last week, and I get this amazing email to pre-order your new book, The Risk Paradox, Life Lessons from 102 Amazing Risk Takers. So I'm immediately intrigued. Mm-hmm. And here we are. So welcome to the show. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
You bet.
So first and foremost, I want to know, I got a book coming out also. We know this. We've both been in the process. What made you want to write a book?
I think I'm not going to speak for all of humanity, but I'll take some liberties and say, everyone has a book in them. Most people probably get to the point where they think about it as well. I don't know that I ever thought seriously about it, honestly. I'm a business writer. I write in numbered bullet points, as all my different management teams will tell you. So I didn't ever think it would happen. It started because, the co-author Doug and I have been friends for years. He started on a writing career. I thought it was great. We took a company public together And then I retired off the board and he retired from being CEO shortly afterwards. And he got into writing, like a writing coach, 2,500 words a day, like going at it for years. And he got out his first memoir type of book. It was, I enjoyed it. We were talking about books. He was interested in risk. He and I are a good complementary pair. He's not a natural risk taker, I would say. Just before reading the book, I think you'd say that there are people that you know who are innovative and entrepreneurial and maybe not have a different risk threshold for things that are obvious. He was super interested in it. I guess I was interested in it too, because people would always ask me, that was crazy what you've done with your life. You know, why would you do that? And it never really registered with me as me thinking about it as risk. So that's how it started. It was super interesting. What's this risk idea? We looked all over to find books so we could read about it, about people having data about it. And everything that's ever been written by about risk that's available is about alpha and beta and the VIX and portfolio management theory, or it's someone's story about climbing, you know, a big rock without ropes, or jumping off a suborbital space capsule, or putting all their money into, or going to Vegas and saving FedEx. So those are the types of books about risk. And we didn't think it addressed what normal, it wasn't very relatable. I mean, maybe specific episodes are relatable, but I mean, look, taking your last $5,000 and going to Vegas and putting it all on black in order to save FedEx is not a, it's a good scene in a movie. It's not super relatable for someone who's got childcare and, you know, parent-teacher conferences and a horrible boss, or, you know, a real passion for something and they're stuck in a cube. It just didn't seem as relatable. So we thought, all right, well, we can't find anything about this. And I learn best from people's stories. I tell people that I don't give advice, ever. I share experiences and, I make observations from my point of view, and that's it. So with that in mind, we thought we'd get people's stories so they could share experiences.
That's super cool. And there's so much here. I want to back up a little bit. You said something as you were describing kind of the process, and you're like, people would say to you that it's crazy, you know, what you've done with your life. You know, as everyone, what was crazy in your life? Take us back to kind of, you know, the risk that you took, you know, or what you would define, you know, as crazy to put you in the position to hear that from others.
I'm not a super big fan about talking about myself, but I'll tell you the things that I think with retrospect as a midlife male, I'm 50 now, looking back on it. You know, I went to college and I just honestly getting a job afterwards never crossed my mind. Which sounds just ridiculous and immature, or learning a useful skill. I wanted to learn something interesting, which sounds, and by the way, this is not coming from a privileged upbringing, right? Like we're immigrants. We had $13 in the family bank account, you know, when we, arrived in the States. So, it just never crossed my mind. So I was a philosophy major in undergraduate, and I eventually figured out what to do. I applied to med school. I thought that'd be interesting too. I liked the Nova specials when I was growing up. But that was kind of poor planning, you know, where I went to Rice University in Houston, and it was like everyone was a biology or biochemistry or whatever, do this because this is what they're looking for. There were someone sent me the statistic years later. In the year that I applied for med school, there were two philosophy majors in the entire applicant pool nationwide. We both got in to med school. So that was good. I went through, you know, med school. I ended up at my dream program. I thought I was going to be some hotshot heart surgeon. The breadbasket of heart surgery was Duke. The guy who wrote the book literally was there. He interviewed me and did really well. And then I was at the top of the, you know, I was doing very well there, received accolades and plaudits, working 115 hours a week. So the main thing that people look at is, oh my gosh, you quit. So I was in my second year of cardiothoracic surgery. This is a place that mints, you know, in the late 90s, you could really reliably kind of say, yeah, I'm going to be $1 million a year guy being a heart surgeon, and no one else can do what I do. And it's super cool. It's like you're Maverick from Top Gun for healthcare. And I don't know, I saw a problem. I couldn't let it go. I tell people entrepreneurship is if you are lucky enough and unlucky enough to find something that you can't let go. And so I couldn't let go of this problem. And I didn't know anything about programming, didn't know anything about marketing. I'd never seen a spreadsheet before in my life. And started on the off hours while I was waking up at 4 a.m. and coming home at 10 p.m. every night during surgery residency. And that eventually, after, you know, about a year of that, I walked in and I quit. And it had never happened before, actually. Usually it was people had quit because it was a very rigorous program. If you have any doctors in your audience, you know, Duke Cardiothoracic Surgery was kind of the place where happiness goes to die. And, you know, they would talk about how they had 100%+ divorce rate among their residents. It was that type of place, which, you know, I knew that going in. I was like, look, I'm going to stay married and I'm going to be a happy-go-lucky guy. So I took it as a challenge. But people quit all the time because it was really difficult. I was quitting at the top of my game. I was top of the class, and I was going to sit on a milk crate in a garage with, you know, I don't know, $285,000 of school debt and no money. So looking back on it, that was a terrible idea and something I probably wouldn't advise my children, which is hilarious when you talk about risk. That was the big one. And then there were others down the road.
Mm. How did it work out? I mean, I had this. First of all, what was the problem you saw that you could not let go of, you know, that took you from top of the class to the milk crate?
So when you're in the late 90s, which makes me sound as old as I am.
You're my age, by the way. Let's go. Okay.
Computers are, yeah, I guess for the audience of this podcast, we're all around the same age. So, you know, computers weren't, you know, we weren't looking at our iPhones, checking our lab results on, you know, the local hospital's app. It was super disjointed. Everything was paper. There were computers in the hospitals. When we were at Duke, you just became the top of the class nationwide, Duke Heart Surgery, and then you were immediately at the bottom of the ladder. And in order to make the whole system run, where people fly from all over the world to get treated there for their heart surgery, you had to go to all these computer systems to get all the lab tests. And how do you do that? You have these super highly educated gophers across, I don't know, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 computer systems and write down lab results on an index card for every one of the 50 patients they've taken care of. And you have an army of us. And, you know, we had to draw them out so that you could keep track of them over many days and weeks. That sounds really stupid and incredibly kind of useless and inefficient. I tracked it over the course of a few weeks, and I was spending 8 to 9 hours a day transcribing numbers from a computer screen on the index cards. And I was like, wow, I'm work 120 hours a week, 110, 115, 120 hours a week. And 50 of them are like doing something that a monkey could do. I was like, this is a problem everywhere. Like, so why don't I solve that? So why don't we put it all automagically into something we carry in our pockets electronically? And I don't know, 2 years before that, the Palm Pilot had come out. And it was the hottest personal electronic device in the history of humanity up until that point, even though it's just a glorified calculator. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to make it so that I was not a nerd. I didn't like styluses. I was like, I want a big screen with big buttons and big numbers. And I want it automatically inserted from all of these computer systems onto this, because I carry that in my pocket. And that was the problem. And I was, that's ultimately what we did.
Mm. So did you raise money for that? You had debt, you know, you on the milk, you didn't know what to do again. Now this is,
so
this
I,
is
was, fascinating I was, yeah. So I was working. So in residency, rotate month to month. I was in the ER. I was in the cancer ward. I was in all these places, and you have different hours. Whenever I had a free moment, I was like, how do I do this? And I got on the internet. Yahoo was still a thing back then. I was like, where do I find computer programmers? How much do they cost? I found a couple, you know, pot smoking college students from actually UT. And they're like, I called them up. I think I used a hospital phone, which may put me on the hook for some long distance calls. And I was like, hey, I got this idea. I drew it out on a napkin and then a piece of paper. And I was like, I wanted to do this. You think you can do it? And it was, I mean, it was kind of out of movie. They're like, yeah, bro, that sounds totally cool. We're totally down with that. We'll do that. I was like, great. I have no money. They're like, oh, dude. And it was like, I was talking to Keanu Reeves. They said they'd work on it if I could cover their expenses. They had rent. So then I was like, great. I have no money. So then I went around asking people, how do I get money? And then they're like, you have to ask people for it. And so I would call relatives, friends, people I thought were rich. And they're like, yeah, we believe in you. Where do I get my shares? I was like, what are you talking about? And they're like, for this company. I was like, oh God. So then I found someone. I was like, how do I start a company to give people shares? And then I found a lawyer in town, created a company, created an offering document. All of it was just telling them what I wanted to get done, which is I needed to pay someone to do this thing. That was this picture in my brain. And that's how it started.
Let me ask that concept now, because now I just can this pay somebody to do what needs to get done, you know, in a way, like, I don't know how to do it. Okay. Or this is brand new to me. And so I need to pay somebody to get it done. How did you decide between, I'm going to go pay somebody to go get this done? And I get it kind of like you need a lawyer or you need versus also like, I'm a super smart guy. I'm the top of my class, you know, in cardiothoracic surgery at Duke. Now I'm not, because I went in and quit. Okay. Versus, I guess, paying somebody to do something and knowing what needs to get done versus I'm going to learn it and I'm going to do it myself. You know, where have you and your experience kind of drawn that line? Because I'm sure that that's happened a number of times, you know, even this first company, but I find with entrepreneurs like and successful people, they're really good and knowing what they need to delegate or hire out for or find and what they actually want to do themselves. Hmm?
That may be the best question I've ever gotten.
We're done now. Guys, thanks for listening to the podcast. This is going to be a reel, okay? Instead of
you guys are getting your money's worth, podcast listeners. That's an excellent question. So this is actually one of the number one things. And honestly, I'll state this. I don't know. I don't have a lesson plan for this, but I am not smarter than everyone. I'm not anything than anyone. If I have anything, I'm super comfortable. So I would say I am more comfortable than most people not knowing things. And knowing that someone else knows something better. That is one half of it. The other half of it is that I have a lot of confidence in that I'm smart enough where, or I'm confident enough where I feel like I'm smart enough where someone should be able to explain this to me who is an expert. So there's two things there. One is I'm super comfortable saying, I don't know. Like, can you explain this to me? What needs to happen? And you'd be super surprised. I never went to business class in my entire life. I never took an accounting class in my entire life. And I chaired a public company audit committee. took a business finance trend. I never learned anything. I would find someone who was supposed to be an expert in that field. And then I'd have them explain it to me of what they were going to do. The best filter that I've ever been able to have on this is if I found the other person could break it down so that I could understand it. That must mean they're pretty good. And I think there's two things. There's knowing how to do it and being an expert in it, and then being good enough to know how to simplify it so someone who is ignorant like me can understand it. But, you know, ignorant with some capacity to process information. And that's what I did. If I talk to someone and so it's the old Reagan thing, right? Trust but verify. I would find the expert and then I would say, I don't understand this. Explain to me what needs to be done. Explain to me what you're going to do. And then they would explain the thing. And if I didn't understand it, I'd be like, okay, I need to find somebody else. And I would just go and find experts until they could explain it to me. And I'm not dumb, but I'm not an expert. And if I could understand it and understand why, that must mean they were smart enough to do it in a way that I trusted. And that is the single number one thing for that time and forever after. That's basically the only playbook I've ever run.
Wow. So good and so much to it. So you build the company, you quit med school. I know that we're going to skip over a lot, but I assume when you're in medical school, what is it, mid, late 20s? Like you're not even 30 at that point, right?
Yep.
And you're married. You mentioned children or no children at that point. I know your kids.
No kids.
No kids at that point. Okay. So you probably caught some flack for dropping out. Family, why, like was Anita okay with it? Like family okay with this? Your professors, like you catch some flack, but you quit. Now you form a company and you then do you have it anywhere I'm wrong or as I string this together, you not only form the company, now the company becomes super successful. Right? Now I'm going to leave out a lot, but you sell the company goes public. Right? So, and then Doug, you said, was Doug in this company? Am I putting this all together too?
Yeah. So,
and he retires, right?
Yeah. So let me, so the sequence was, is so first of all, there's two things that I'm good at, or I don't know that I'm good at. They're the best things that I can be at, which is I'm totally okay not knowing things, and I'm really good at learning. The second thing is I'm not big on regret, or if I feel like I've thought through everything and I've made a decision, I focus on making good decisions. So, I put a lot of effort into decision-making, but once that's done, unless someone's bringing me new information, you know, my parents kind of knew that at that point. My wife knew that at that point. It was like, you know, those are the only people that mattered. And they were like, yeah, okay. We've never been able to we've never given you advice. So just, okay, that was it. That was the conversation. So we sold the company. I ran, worked for the company that bought us. It was a big Canadian company called Thomson. It's now Thomson Reuters. We were strategically supposed to be the golden child to kind of bring this hot company was supposed to bring this kind of old blue blood company into the sexified kind of tech industry. I met Doug there. So Doug was buried deep within this organization and he was super capable. I didn't help him except kind of expose other people to how capable he was. And then he eventually ended up running all the products for this billion-dollar business. And then I quit that company. They I stayed there for 2 years. I was the last I went through the Reuters acquisition. I bought 25 companies. They told me they wanted me to be to run the business. And I was 32 at the time, maybe 33, maybe 34. I don't remember, something like that. And, I said, great. And then, about 2 weeks later, I quit. I told them it's not them, it's me. And I quit kind of, so I was going to be, they told me at least that I was going to be the golden child. And, you know, the next step after that was running all of Thompson. And so, I quit. So that was probably another big risk that people note if they ever ask or they know my story. But then that's where I met Doug.
Mm. So now there's a little bit of a trend developing in how you make decisions, and also kind of this fearlessness to me. You talk about confidence, you know, this fearlessness to make decisions in the face of, again, I'm top of my class, or I'm being anointed the golden child. I may make an assumption here, correct me if I'm wrong. By the time you were anointed the golden child, you were also in a position financially to do things because you wanted to, not necessarily because you had to. You know? So it was a different kind of quitting than going to the milk crate, right?
Yeah, it was, they kind of felt the same. You know, I would say like, look, you know, I'm human, man. Like there's all of us, you know, your group, your audience, you know, there's all of it. Are people going to forget me? Is what I'm doing important? Does it matter how much money is involved? All of that was there. There was something there's this great quote that I wrote down from one of the interviewees in the book. And it was, what you value isn't what you say, it's what you tolerate. And I remember when he said that, I stopped the interview and I was like, hold up, I need to write this down. Because I thought that was super insightful. None of us are going out and intentionally saying, I don't know, I want to grow up and have a bad relationship with my wife. I want to grow up and have a bad relationship with my kids. I want to go 5 years and never see any of my friends or have people over for dinner. Or, you know, none of us are going and saying those things. Life gets in the way. It's complicated. And, but when you get it down to a few things, it's easier to say, you know, what is it that you're going to tolerate? What is it that you're going to accept? You know, for leaving residency, for me, it's been pretty simple. It was, regret and guilt. I avoid those. Right. So it was, you know, it's Bezos has talked about this subsequently. I didn't have his wisdom, or I didn't have access to his books back then, but I had my own regret minimization framework of, you know, am I ever going to regret, even if I succeed as a cardiothoracic surgeon, not pursuing this? And then the job at, you know, when they were like, hey, run this multi-billion dollar business. And then I quit after they offered me the job is, am I going to like the type of person that I'm going to become, if I take this? And, and I'd been there long enough. I tried to find somebody who was someone I could admire and there wasn't. And, I was like, oh, I just needed to see somebody do something, do the thing I was about to do, and be a person that I would admire and wanted to be. And I looked hard all over and I couldn't find that person. And so I was like, I saw it as a decision of sign up for all these riches and fame and private jets and dinners with, you know, just all of the inside whatever that I read about. And, but I didn't like any of the people that I met, or I don't say I didn't like them. I didn't want to become any of the people that were in there.
Mm. I'm pausing. That lands like really, really hard. The Midlife Mail podcast would not be possible without the support of some incredible brand partners. I only recommend brands I use, believe in, and trust, and each brand was handpicked by me for a specific reason. I believe in these guys not just because they're great companies with great people behind them, but because the stuff works. I use these to stay at my peak, and I suggest you do too. So go over to midlifemail.com and click on special offers for exclusive Midlife Mail discounts and promotions. So how do you, you know, now you say you make good decisions, you know, that you're good at making good decisions. And I respect that a lot. What do you choose? What do you do? You know, now, obviously we'll get to the book. So you spent time writing a book. What other good decisions do you feel, again, that you've made? You know, you say you boil it down, you know, to a few things. And I always say a lot, you know, knowing what's important is what's most important. Like rule or step number one, like in my program is, you know, knowing what's most important is what's most important. And a lot of men in particular, they struggle with that. You ask them and they don't know there. You know, what's been important to you, and subsequently, what choices have you made when you to decide to do the things that you've done?
So thank you. You're very kind. I wouldn't say that I make good decisions. What I'd say is that I try my hardest to make decisions in a way that I can live with myself. Because I make decisions all the time that don't work out. I just don't judge it that way. So this regret minimization framework, like it's kind of a one-trick pony where for me, I know this sounds really stupid, but when I was younger, I would do this. I would like go into a room, turn off all the lights, sit in a chair and close my eyes and imagine myself looking out over, you know, imagine some, you know, house in the country with a wraparound white porch overlooking fields of grass and wheat with a big tree and a tire swing and kids and grandkids running around. I'm 85 years old in a rocking chair. So I try and inhabit that. And then I think about what I would regret. And it's specifically around a particular thing that I'm going to be doing if it's a big decision. And it takes a little bit of effort because you can't just, it'd be convenient to be like, oh, am I going to regret this? Yes, no. Like I have to play out all of the consequences from it. So when you put a lot of effort into making decisions like that, I have to play out all the consequences of, so why did, when I quit this big public company, when they were like, hey, run this, I had young kids by that point. And I saw what the life was. I mean, I'll tell you this. I didn't like whiskey before I started there. After there, I could drink it like a fish. Okay. Like, and it was, I was overseas all the time. I was on private jets all the time. I'm in the meetings with foreign dignitaries. We're buying Reuters, which is an iconic like French company. And we're at the club, the country clubs, you know, and David Thompson was the richest guy in Canada. Okay. And so, this isn't anything against the company. This is just the exposure of kind of like, okay, I'm caricaturizing what is on the other end of that. Mm-hmm. And what is the cost? What are the consequences? So the reason I sit in a dark room and close my eyes and imagine all of that is I'm like, okay, I become whatever, I don't know, some mega celebrity CEO who is in the Fortune 500 and has, I had two assistants, each were making $150,000. Okay. I had a, you know, ridiculous expense account that was more than I made annually every month. And I'm not saying that to be like, oh, look at me. It was, I had an idea. I got some exposure to what it was going to be like. And, but I, you know, when I'm sitting there and they're throwing their arms over my shoulder, they weren't rushing away to see their kids' basketball game or see their kid's dance recital. And they were gone a week, a month at a time. And they were trying to find somebody to pay a bunch of money to go to some Ivy League school. And I don't know, it just wasn't what I wanted in my life. And so the decision-making framework is really putting in the work to like get in my own head of what all the consequences mean. So if you make a bunch of money, if I become a social media influencer and I get a bunch of people who follow me or do whatever, and I'm not casting aspersions on any of that, right? What are the consequences of what that means to me and my daily life? And I've never been on Facebook. I've never been on Twitter. I've never been on Instagram. And again, I don't cast any aspersions or find it to be negative for anyone or to be good or bad, or there's no value judgments. But I, you know, when Twitter came out, I was like, what is the impact of this on my life long-term? And what does it mean? Mm. If Facebook comes out, I was like, okay, what is the impact of this on my life long-term? And what it means for me to spend time with my family and have a mental space where I can focus on what I care about. And so it's really that thing. It's the regret minimization framework, but it takes a lot of work and honesty with yourself to kind of run the thread all the way out and not stop at the convenient points that are shiny.
Mm. Yep. You know, the definition of success, you know, or the definition of wealth, you know, it's different for everyone. You know, at that point, you know, you're what you're exposed to. And I say this to someone, look, my first job out of college was at Miramax Films. I was Harvey Weinstein's assistant. Mm-hmm. Not exactly a great mentor, but to your point, like here I am right out of college thinking I want to be in the entertainment industry again, and it's private jets and staying at the Peninsula Hotel, and I'm 21 years old and a platinum American Express card that I don't pay, you know, at all, and doing all these things and getting ashtrays thrown at my head in toxic work environment and like absolute, you know, like craziness, you know, overall. And you can start to lose perspective, you know, very, very quickly. And then later on, I started a company very much like you. I was selling DVDs out of the trunk of my car. And I remember actually I was sitting, you know, milk crates were holding up the conference table in the one room that I didn't even rent. It was a friend of mine who owned a building off of like 610 Southwest Freeway in like not a great area. And it was a little MRI facility. And he had one room that he gave me that I could use, milk crates holding up the conference table and a computer in one end. And every time the MRI machines were used, like the lights would flicker, you know, and we'd worry about our computer going off and losing all the editing and stuff. And ended up, you know, selling these DVDs out of the trunk of my car to getting acquired by Michael Eisner, who was the former CEO of Disney. And the next thing I know, Kate and I are staying in Aspen and Malibu and these other places. And the only other, the kind of the downside, I think, where the delta is and some of the differences with you, I was not making a lot of money. I was around like incredible wealth and the company was like growing and everything. But to your point, like you start to see all these things and you start to wonder what success really looks like and how much and what do you have to trade. And then when I sold out of that, I still wasn't, you know, again, life change. Like now I don't have to do any. I still had to do things. I had young children also, and get back into another organization. And you look ahead. So much of what you're saying is, am I going to like the person I'm going to become? And I spent years feeling and or knowing I don't think I am, or I know I'm not. But right now I have to do this until we can get to a point, and ultimately did where there was another exit and we went public. And finally, like, yeah, I was able to say, okay, I don't have to anymore in there. And I guess, you know, where I'm going with this also is, did you have like, whether it was a number, was there like a number? Was there anything that you were just like, hey, if I can get from here to here, you know, I'm seeing all these signs or I genuinely feel this way. Mm-hmm. But I'm not, again, now I am married. Now I do have the kids. Now I'm not going back necessarily to the milk crate. You know, there's a certain kind of life I do want. I guess that bridge, you know, like how much am I going to tolerate and for how long, you know, and what am I willing to then do or not do?
If that makes sense, that might be the longest question you've ever gotten to, but.
I think this is, you know what love languages are, right? Like, so one of them is like, I'm going to simplify it, but it's like, oh, you know, gift giving or something in their items. I would say people have intrinsic kind of life languages. I'm making up a word there, things that they value. And so I don't think my path is right for everyone. I think I got lucky, frankly. I'm like, I have a complete absence of gifts and things from my life languages. And it just never, I don't know, I'll spend 50 grand on a trip or something, right? Which sounds ridiculous. And I say that not to, what I mean is like the trip and the experience is what versus, you know, I won't spend $3,000 on a car or, you know, so my point is like, I think everyone has different life languages, you know, where it's like, this is what I enjoy. This brings me fulfillment. I don't cast aspersions or make any value judgments on some people. They feel better. They want to wear nice clothes. They want to have certain nice things. And that's great. For me, it was always things that weren't really visible. Right. So, you know, after I made a ton of money, we lived in a little, you know, townhome. I just happened to buy it in cash. And so, so for me, I think that there was never a number. I did ask myself the question and I probably had some experiences earlier than others because I got lucky and had some success. I was like, oh, what's the point of all this? Where does this stop? I think for me, the place where it intervened was, this is going to sound really simplistic. I got exposed to all these people and it wasn't just in a really public setting. It was in private settings. Okay. I saw these people who to the external world appeared to be something, you know, very accomplished, very materially wealthy, et cetera. And I see what they look like in the morning and that they have to take out the trash and they're wearing a bathrobe and like there's weeds growing in their lawn and they have this huge house, but like the stone here broke and they, you know, it's someone's got to come and it's a huge pain in the butt. This is the whole extended version of everyone puts their pants on one leg at a time. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that was actually what stuck with me is that I tell my kids this, and this is where, hopefully there's, I don't know, some transmission to them, but I'm like, look, man, you know, Kim Kardashian may look like that or Justin Bieber may look like that, but like someone's not there to take out the trash all the time. Like they need to, you know, they have their compost or whatever their recycling bin smells too. And it leaks. And, you know, there's like, they're all human beings. So that gave me a really good perspective where when you asked, what is the number? What was enough? I didn't have any sense when I was younger because I had a really great life. I was super happy when I was making 20,000, when I was making 25,000, when I was making 50,000, when I was making nothing and I was paying 30 grand a year to go to whatever, 50 grand a year to go to med school. I was always happy. But what I said was I want to have enough to not worry about if the air conditioner fails or if my kids can go to college. And that sounds like incredibly entitled. And it is, I'm super privileged. But that was it. There was no dollar amount. It was, I want to be able to go out to dinner if I need to with the whole family. I want to be able to have my friends over whenever it is that I want. And I want to be able to, you know, have my kids go to school and I want to not think about it if the car breaks down or the air conditioning goes out or we need to, the house floods. So there wasn't ever never a number. It was mostly about my life language is, I call it low friction living, which is I want to be able to go through life with the least amount of friction around the stuff that I don't care about so that I can spend all my emotional and mental energy on the stuff that I do care about.
Wow. That's my stop the interview moment right there. Like, okay, low friction,
low friction living.
Living, yes.
My friends keep telling me that I should publish a book called Low Friction Living, because that's the thing that all my friends take away. They're trying to reduce the friction.
I'm in. And one of the reasons I was asking that question is because, look, man, we know a lot of these guys. Okay. We do, for better or for worse, we know a lot of these guys. So when you just talk about midlife males and the men that are listening, and I hear from guys now all across the country, actually all across the world, I'm incredibly blessed. I really have a hard time wrapping my head and my heart and even my hands around what's actually transpired, that I hear, you know, from men like this. There's a lot of guys, unfortunately, that are trapped, you know, out there, that have a lot of friction. I'll use your word now, have a ton of friction. You know, yes, they do have the beautiful family, the wife and the children. But when you and from the outside looking in, even the job, mm-hmm, but there's a lot of friction because it's an expensive house and they're playing it close. You know, if the air conditioning breaks versus, you know, does it have to be replaced versus fixed? There's a big source of friction, you know, in there. The expensive cars in the driveway. You know, the schools, everything. We've been in places where, look, there's some people who can spend $50,000 on a quilt made by a bunch of, you know, lower elementary students. There are other people who are struggling to keep their child, you know, in school, at the same school. And yeah, you know, that's a lot of friction. And the advice, you know, to them, this, you know, can I quit my job and, you know, to follow my passion? Or I don't even know what my passion is. I just know that I'm not passionate about this, or I'm miserable. You talked about being happy at various stages. And I talk a lot about the struggle with happiness. Hmm?
Yeah. You know, this is going to sound really funny. I don't know what it was, but when I was younger, I spent a lot of time reading about what old people said. I still do. I find it fascinating, but I need less of it now. And the reason is that there's a person in the book that we interviewed. He was like on death's doorstep for like, you know, a long time as a kid. Okay. Like cancer, you know, leukemia, like battling it out, single digit percent chance of living, you know, looks like a husk of himself, makes it out the other side, you know, super successful, you know, now. I knew him, I met him, you know, 25, 30 years ago now. From the moment I met him, we were fast friends, but he was my same age, but he seemed like a dude who was 25 years older. It was just, he's even keel, just knew what was important. Nothing, the stuff that I freaked out about in my 20s or 30s or whatever, right? We've been great friends for a long time. It was like talking to, you know, a 60-year-old. Like, you know, he was just so, he didn't give advice. He would just lend a perspective. I was like, what is going on? And then, you know, he was interviewed for the book because he's gone on to do incredible things. The main thing there is perspective. And here's the thing. If you know how the end of the game is going to play out, right? Like, who's your favorite sports team, right? I'll tell you, like Cleveland Cavaliers. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Every few months, I like replay the entire 7-game series of, you know, their recent championship, just to, because I'm a nerd. And I know how it's going to end, but I still enjoy watching it, okay? I'll rewatch movies. I'll reread books. I know how it's going to end, but I still enjoy the ride, right? Perspective about life and reading what old people have to say, and this gift that my friend gave me about perspective. He's seen what death is. He's seen what it would be like if he lost it all. He lived it like head in a toilet for a year, you know, and wanting to die. It's very clarifying. You know how the movie's going to end. And that doesn't mean you don't still enjoy the movie. You still can make it a great movie. I love watching the Cavs win in 7 games. It's even better because I know the ending. Here's the thing. For me, like, that's what makes the decisions easier on the compromises, which is I know how it's going to end. I'm going to be immobile in my bed, sleeping in my own you know, whatever, hopefully comfortably, but, you know, someone's going to have to feed me or take care of me or who knows, whatever it is, like, and I'm going to value certain things and wish I had done or wanted certain things. That's, I know this sounds terrible, but even Steve Jobs said it, right? In one of his speeches, he's like, imagine your death and that'll keep you motivated. For me, I kind of just take, that's the point on that is it gives me perspective when I have to make decisions. And when I feel like there's no way out and trapped in anything, that's super liberating and clarifying.
Man, I want to thank you. Yeah, I want to thank you for sharing all of that. Because, you know, look, you're one of the most humble people I know. And getting you speaking and sharing and talking really and sharing your perspective has been really, really terrific. You interviewed 102 amazing, you know, risk takers for the book, The Risk Paradox. What's your takeaway?
That's so good. Everyone's got a story and everyone's dealing with risk. It's, you know, it's funny. One of the guys who read the book or one of the people, he's another author, best-selling author, you know, I don't want to break my hand slapping my back so hard, but he was like, hey man, you totally nailed it. Risk is like the single biggest driver in life. Like, I mean, look, you got to decide whether or not you're going to get in the car because, you know, statistics say, you know, whatever percent there's, you know, gets a car accident, fatal car accident, you know, I don't know, am I going to get on a plane? Like we just choose to accept it, right? And then there are the ones that we remember, right? The ones that you could talk about on a podcast, like I quit residency. I turned down the job to run a big company. I did X, Y. Everyone's got a story. Everyone's dealing with risk. A lot of these, here's the other thing. The things you see of people, they found DirecTV. They found 1-800-GOT-JUNK. They founded this iconic fashion brand, and the things that you know, you're getting one frame of their movie, right? And then, you know, they're real people. They were thinking about like, oh my gosh, I got this dead end job. Do I quit this dead end job? I'm delivering pizzas. I got rejected from this place. Well, that means I'm going to be deported because I'm an immigrant. Okay. And I'm going to walk in there and fight for it with the head of the school. Like, it's so fascinating. I'm so much more fascinated by other people's stories than mine. And I would say the takeaway is everyone who's listening has an incredible risk narrative. And I think that, I think it's really great. I talk with people, friends in different businesses and running different things. Transactions, big dollar things or whatever. A lot of times I make better decisions just hearing from someone else, hearing about their experiences. It's like mental health and Kevin Love talking about mental health in the NBA or, you know, hearing some famous person talking about them going through, like for these types of things around risk and around business and success, hearing someone else's stories and that the troubles they went through is just helpful. Maybe I'm not going to run the play they ran, but it helps because you're like, oh, they found this iconic brand that's in every store I've ever been to and look what they went through. And I think that's great. I think that's great.
I do too. I couldn't agree more. You know, I feel like there's this incredible opportunity, you know, and I can't like, you have to listen to people's stories, hear their stories, you know, you aggregate everything that's there. That's like what I call it, you know, you can aggregate everything there. You can curate it down to kind of what works for you, you know, and what really lands with you and what's going to, and to your point, then we eliminate what doesn't, everything else. But going through this process of listening to people share their stories and everybody has them, what their risk tolerance is. People have different tolerance for risk. And I spent years in risk management, you know, if you will, in risk mitigation. I think now, to an extent, I'm still doing it. It's just a different kind of risk. You know, now I'm talking to men about the risks that they take, you know, in all aspects of their lives? And how do we mitigate some of those risks? Is it, again, irresponsible to quit your job to go follow your passion when you're making 50 a month and you're spending 60 a month, you know, overall, you don't have any runway to do it, you know, like certain things? Or how do we plant, you know, mental health and confidence and security? How do we get you to stay there, but get better control, you know, of your life and your purpose and how you do things? I find all these things fascinating, in particular, the subject of risk and how many different ways it can be, you know, applied into all facets of our life, and particularly as it pertains to regret, which you spoke about in detail, or not having regret, more importantly, not living with regret or making the decisions that would lead you, you know, to regret. And you know, the readings of you know, what people say on their deathbeds, you know, the elderly, the old, like looking back. And I think that's such a poignant point in perspective, you know, to be like, what do people really think about, you know, and what's really important when they've experienced, quote unquote, it all? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, everyone's got, I just went to a small gathering last night. I mean, this guy is, I don't know, he's one of X number of billionaires in Texas. I'm sure Texas has a lot. He's a legend in his field. He's hobnobbing with presidents all over the place. You know, he's in Houston. We have a lot of billionaires in Houston, but he's in his 80s. Okay. And I'm, you know, I don't know the man well. But there's real value in seeing what happens at the end of the day. He's got all the money in the world, right? And, you know, what does he care about? What does he think about, right? So he, you know, at the gathering, like he made sure, like he had his tribe around him and they were all like his good friends. They're all in their 80s too. They're all geriatric. But, you know, it wasn't like his biggest customer. It wasn't his like, you know, investment banker. It wasn't his like, I don't know. Wasn't anyone from, you know, it was like the people that were important to him. And, you know, Warren Buffett said this during his interview, and I loved it, to Maria Bartiromo. This is like 15 years ago in Davos on CNBC. They're asking about interest rates or whatever it was. And it was something about that was very financial. It's on CNBC, for God's sakes, during the witching hour, 4 o'clock, right? Mm-hmm. And what do you want to be remembered for? I mean, this is like 15 years ago. They were already planning for him to die. And, or what do you consider success? And he's like, you know, I want to be surrounded by people I love and who love me. And it was like full stop. And that was it. That was like, what was his success? Right. And, it was like, he's surrounded by like prime ministers and like Jamie Dimon or whoever else. And he's throwing love around and, you know, and you know, on CNBC. And it's true. Once you see it, it's like, it's one thing to love people. It's another thing to have them love you, because that costs. And, and I'm just not willing to, have, you know, I want to have kids that love me. I want to have friends that love me. I want to have a spouse that loves me.
And there it is. There it is. Alan Ying. The Risk Paradox, Life Lessons from 102 Amazing Risk Takers. Such incredible perspective. Are you one of them, of the 102 in the book? Did you include
yourself? I wasn't. We had to bump someone. And then Doug said I had to be in there. So I am one of the two. One of the 100. So there are 101 besides me.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Okay. Because again, I look forward to knowing you and now, you know, having this conversation also. I look forward to reading it. I'm so glad that you're included in the book. It actually surprises me. I was expecting the answer to be no, actually you're not. And you
there's 24, there's 24 kind of featured stories. I am not a featured story. So, I am the least interesting person for me to talk about. So
see, I disagree with you. And that's why I'm surprised that you're in there. And I'm pleasantly surprised that you're in there. And I'm really, really happy that you're on the show today again, because again, just knowing how humble you are and modest and not giving advice, but rather sharing experiences and so on and so forth, you know, to me, you know, you talk about everybody having a story. I genuinely believe that. More often than not, the stories I want to hear and the stories I want to tell or help tell and share are from those that, quite frankly, don't tell their story a lot. You know, like they look to share other people's stories. They're not looking to give advice, you know, and even share. They want to do the listening, you know, out there. And they're the ones you don't hear about all the time and that don't put themselves out there, or that will drop the kind of, you know, quiet little bombshell of like, I've never been on Twitter. I've never been on Facebook. I've never been on Instagram. And then here comes the other bombshell. I'm just going to go hang out in this room with an 80-year-old billionaire and a bunch of other billionaires. You know, the same. Okay. That kind of access, that kind of perspective, that kind of insight, you know, is hugely impactful. So thank you for being here today. Alan, where do people go get the book?
You know, I think Amazon's eating the world. Barnes & Noble has it. There's the publisher website is at Amplify. I narrated the audiobook, which is perhaps the most egotistical thing I'll ever do. But we tried out a bunch of voices and the publisher said mine was the best. So
there you
Audible
go.
Audible has it as well.
Hey, I just want you to know they might say that to all of the authors. I narrated them.
I know. I think that's code for it costs less if you do this.
Why don't you go do it? You're the best. We listen to everybody else and you're the best. Well, listen, people have now listened to you for an hour. They can attest to knowing your voice. Okay. They now can hear the voice. They can place the voice with the book. Head on over to Amazon, wherever books are ordered, and go get yourself, guys, a copy of The Risk Paradox, Life Lessons from 102 Amazing Risk Takers by Alan Yang, who is here today. And I would be remiss if I did not mention, and Doug Schneider, also, who is your co-writer and on the cover of the book as well. So guys, you are going to find those tales very, very motivating, thought-provoking, relatable and readable. So pick it up, man. I'm not going to tell you to follow Alan anywhere else because you're not going to find him anywhere else. So this is the place, right?
That's it. Thank you.
That is it. All right, guys. Another episode of the Midlife Male Podcast in the books. Thank you so much for supporting. Please, if you can, leave that 5-star rating. Give us a positive review. It really helps to keep the Midlife Male movement growing. If you need to reach me, I am not hard to find, okay? Like Alan Yang, find me at greg@midlifemail.com. You can follow me on Instagram at Greg Scheinman, spend a lot of time on LinkedIn, and I promise you I will get back to you. It may not be right away, but I will get back to you. All right, thanks so much. Until next week, we are out.
If you're interested in coaching and taking this conversation deeper so that you can achieve your personal and professional goals, be sure to head over to midlifemail.com and check out the Work With Me page to explore options.
We are actuaries. In a world filled with unpredictability, we use our math skills to navigate uncertainty. Actuaries make a difference in people's lives across industries and the world. Actuaries have the freedom to work anywhere. And according to U.S. News & World Report, we're the 25th top-paying career. Make an impact as a fact seeker and a truth teller. Use your math skills for good as an actuary. The world needs you.